Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey everybody, this is Angela Orkin. Welcome back to part two of my interview with Judge Scott Bernstein on implicit bias. We left off talking about bias from a systemic perspective. Now we're going to talk more about how you can deal with it in your day-to-day practice. We hope you enjoy the episode. Well, let's take one step back from that, and let's say maybe it's not rising to the level of something measurable on a systemic basis, but let's say you're in a meeting and all the professionals are around and talking about the likelihood of reunification, for example, and you sort of see you're now aware and you see some people kind of making assumptions based on these implicit biases. Is it really just a matter of asking more questions and slowing everyone down, or are there particular ways that you go about bringing it to light?
Yeah, I don't think it's very effective as a technique to look at someone and say, I think you're a racist. That just doesn't work very well. No. But by asking a lot of questions, you can start to break down people's barriers a little bit. And there are times, even in the courtroom, when I'll even ask, are certain assumptions about race or gender or ethnicity or sexual orientation factoring at all into the decisions? And let's have a discussion about this publicly. I'm not sure that's an effective way for a lawyer to handle it in a meeting. Maybe it is. Maybe asking questions in a less direct fashion is better. The technique works really well when you're a judge because people don't challenge me quite the same way, but at least not to my face. but I think that you can ask an awful lot of questions in a concurrent case plan meeting, for example, or in a conversation in a conference room, and just ask a lot of questions and see if you can elicit some other responses.
Yeah, I really like the focus on just slowing down, because it's admittedly very difficult when you're in these high caseload areas. But maybe it's a matter of learning how to ask questions that in a way that, again, doesn't assume anything negative on the part of anyone else, and you're just bringing to light maybe some of the stereotypes. Like, are we assuming that grandma can't parent these children because her own daughter has struggled so much?
Right.
Is that the kind of question?
Sure. It can't hurt to ask that question. And the answer is maybe that's accurate and maybe it's not. But if you're making an assumption that it's always accurate, that's where the problem comes in. Sure, I understand that slowing the train down is an unpopular thing to do with caseloads and time pressures and everything. But the goal here is to get it right. And sometimes you only have one chance to get it right. And you cannot make an assumption that this case is like any other case, particularly these cases where so much emotion is involved. An emotional reaction to something is almost by definition not logical. Well, the legal system is nothing if not logical. At least it's supposed to be nothing if not logical. And in order to make sure that we're making decisions that are not based on emotion, but are based on the facts and the law, we need to call it out. We need to slow it down. We need to say, what are we doing here? And we need to question. And that's the great job of lawyers, is to question.
Absolutely.
I recently heard a lecture, if you will, by this author who wrote a book about a woman who was a survivor of the Holocaust. She was 21 years old, and she was placed in charge of, back then they called it an orphanage, in France, that housed 100 young boys who had been rescued from concentration camps after the war, who had been liberated. All of these boys had lived in unimaginable circumstances and were the only survivors of their families and extended families who'd all been murdered by the Nazis. And the initial director of this home quit. The assistant director home of the home quit. Several other successive ones quit. No one could deal with it, and they said, these boys are violent, they are ungovernable, they are too broken. Some of them had evaluations where they were described as born deviants and sociopaths. And this woman with no training and no background and no education came in, and the first thing she said was, what's going on? Well, these boys steal everything in sight, and it's worse at mealtime. And they literally steal everything. Well, think about where they came from, where stealing food was survival. I mean, life and death survival. And the first thing she did was she said, okay, we don't have mealtimes anymore. The kitchen is open 24 hours a day. This is your food. This is where you're living now. There are no restrictions. If you're hungry, come eat. If you're not hungry, you don't have to. And within a matter of days, the stealing stopped. So sometimes it's a matter of looking at a situation differently than you've ever seen it before. In fact, these children were not ungovernable, were not sociopaths. Yes, they had been traumatized in a way that most of us can never humanly imagine, but they can be reached, and in fact they were. And it turns out that all of these boys turned out to have very successful lives and very successful careers. Doctors, lawyers, accountants, bankers, businessmen. And one who was constantly scribbling on a book somewhere or on a pad of paper somewhere turned out to be the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elie Wiesel.
Where can people read this story? Because I think folks might want to read the whole thing.
I believe it's called The Boys from Buchenwald.
Okay.
But I heard a lecture from the author recently, okay. And I was shocked because it really spoke to me in a way by saying all these other so-called professionals made assumptions about these boys, and the assumptions that they all made were inaccurate, and that it took someone looking at the situation differently to try to restore some humanity to these really traumatized and broken children. And the results were incredible.
Well, one of the young women that we interviewed in the Youth Voice video that will be played later in the conference, she said, and I can't forget it, she said, you know, everybody before they met me read a file. They didn't bother to talk to me and meet me. If they had, they would know how successful I was going to be.
Right.
And I loved it. Because we do. I mean, that's the first thing you do. You get a file, you read it, you're like, oh, man. You know, and you read all the stuff, and you're coming in, you know, with assumptions about what this child, you know, what their obstacles are going to be. Maybe it's not, maybe something that normally isn't. Maybe that child builds on that, and that becomes a strength. And I think that, you know, kind of flipping the story or allowing for a different story is a lot of what lawyers can do, particularly when they're representing these older youth that have, you know, a plan for themselves.
I agree with you. I'm not even sure it's only the older ones. Sometimes the elementary school age children have a plan too, and they deserve to have their dreams considered. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to be an astronaut or a fireman or a president of the United States, but they deserve to have those dreams respected.
Absolutely.
And I also think that it's important, particularly for the children who are going through the system, that the children believe the system is fair. Because if the children don't believe the system is fair, then they're not going to want to engage with the system. And a lot of people really are trying to do the right thing. Lawyers, social workers, therapists, educators, teachers are trying to help these kids. But if the kids are distrustful of the system, then they're not ready to get the help that they want or they need. And there are things that you can do, very concrete steps that you can do to get people to believe that the system is fair. And the most important one is to listen to them. Let them be heard. Another really important one is to be trustworthy. If you say, I want to talk to you on Tuesday, then make sure you talk to them on Tuesday. If you say we're going to meet for 30 minutes, then meet for 30 minutes. Don't meet for 5 minutes and say, I'm done with you. You know, that kind of thing. Also, it's really important. Kids have an innate sense of fairness in the neutrality of our system. I mean, we've all heard kids, when one child gets something and another one doesn't get something, and the kids go, that's not fair. Mm-hmm. Kids have an innate sense of fairness. Sure. So you have to make sure that you understand the system from their perspective and that it's seen as fair. So if you are a lawyer representing a child and your client sees you laughing and joking with the DFACS lawyer who's trying to do something negative to them, then the kid's not going to think that you're on their side unless you have a conversation with them and say, this is important to make the system work better, and having professional collegiality is really important in our world. I'm not sure a kid will even get that, but you have to try it, or you have to not do it in front of the child.
I think, yeah, and I think that goes for parents, too. I
mean, of course it does.
I remember when I first started representing kids in the system, watching, you know, I was observing and seeing that go on, but I found that most of the time they would wait until, you know, everyone exited the courtroom to laugh or joke or do the kind of things that sometimes help with burnout for professionals. But they, you know, most of the time would wait until everybody involved had left the courtroom. But yep. Not always. I mean, everybody goes to lunch sometimes, and it could be perceived that way too. And I think that those conversations can be very important.
And here's a nice trick for lawyers. Don't assume that the judge can't hear you when you leave the courtroom and the door closes. The doors are probably not that thick, and we can still hear you when you're right outside the courtroom talking. And if you're having conversations with your clients that you don't want people to overhear, or if you're laughing with opposing counsel, we can hear it, and chances are good the kids can hear it too. And they're making assumptions about things as well, and maybe those assumptions aren't accurate, but you'd be a lot better off if there was a basic sense of trust, that these kids had a sense that the system really was fair. Another thing that's really important is that you show respect to these children. And everyone has his or her own personality, and you've got to find a way to do that. But, I had an opportunity to see a teacher once who called every child in her classroom, Mr. So-and-so and Ms. So-and-so. And I thought it was a little formal, it was a little odd, but I realized what it was doing was raising a level of professionalism in the classroom and saying, I'm expecting really good behavior here, and I think the kids really responded to it. And maybe it is appropriate for a lawyer who's representing a child to refer to their client as Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so, even if they're 6 or 8 years old, because it shows a level of respect, respect that they probably haven't gotten anywhere else in their lives. And by the way, any way a lawyer decides to treat a child, a parent, a caseworker, if you've decided that you're going to set up a system in a particular way, then please make sure you do it in every single case. Do it for all kids, and don't make any exceptions. That's another way to combat an implicit bias. If you feel that it's important to have a particular level of formality between you and your client, and when I say formality, I don't mean distance, because you really want your clients to trust you and to know that you care about them. But if you're setting up a system of formality, everyone deserves that same formality, not just the kids who might look like you or talk like you.
That's an excellent point, yeah. Is there anything else you'd want to add?
So I want to talk about classical music for a second. There was a problem in the classical music world where all of the musicians who are hired for jobs with major orchestras around the world were almost exclusively men. And this was true for, frankly, hundreds of years. And it only changed very recently. And I think the way in which it changed is instructive, eye-opening. It used to be that a jury of of people with the orchestra would invite a prospective musician out on stage in the orchestra hall and perform. And they would hear the violinist play, and then they would caucus and decide whether they would offer that person a job or not. And, of course, the people doing the hiring were almost exclusively men. And so to combat some implicit bias, and this wasn't an explicit bias, to combat implicit bias, they did two things. And it took two things to fix the problem. One was they put up a screen so that the jury was on one side and the auditioning musician was on the other side of the screen, so that the people doing the listening couldn't physically see the gender of the person who was performing. That helped, but it didn't fix the problem. What fixed the problem was when they put carpet down on the walkway up to the place where they went to perform, because nobody could hear the high heels of the person coming into audition.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, there were no assumptions, and the people doing the listening could just listen to the music. And I think that's very helpful for people to realize we all need to put up our screen and our carpet, because we should be making decisions only based on the facts of our cases and the law. We should all be making decisions not on the sound of the high heels and not on the appearance, but on what's really important by listening to the music.
That's an excellent point. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Sure. This is a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.